Hey, welcome to this, the 20th episode of season one of Steel Watching. The episode is Steel's Gold. My name is Eric, and I am one of your host/presenters. And we also have...
And I am Sarah, and I am just the Canadian that he found in the snow.
I don't know. As opposed to me, who's an American who gets lost in the snow. Yes. The wonders of and the joys of living up in the north.
Yeah, I figure you're one of the few Americans that understands the Canadian experience, because that's what it's like for all of us.
You know, yes.
Going down south for us just means a little less snow.
Anyway, Steel's Gold. You know, I got to say, well, first of all, let's get the introductory stuff out of the way. First aired March 22nd, 1983, was written by R.J. Stewart with Andrew Laskos and Michael Gleason listed as participating writers, and directed by Bert Brinkerhoff. Now, I got to say, as I was going through and making my notes, you know, watching it and then watching it again to take my notes, I realized something. I had memories of this episode that were not great. I mean, I didn't think it was a terrible episode. I just didn't think it was a really good episode. And in watching this over again and taking my notes, I think it's better than I gave it credit for. So I will have to admit, I've kind of changed my tune on this one a little bit. It's better than I remembered it being.
So I have mixed feelings on this one, and it's not necessarily the episode's fault. I think the issue I have with this one is that it feels, A, like it should be an earlier episode, and we'll get into some of the reasons why later, and okay. B, that it's coming on the heels of two really, really strong character-building episodes. And I think any episode that came after Vintage Steel was immediately going to have some trouble. So,
and I think that might be part of the source of my problem with it that I've had.
Yeah, I think that was because I honestly don't know how I'd feel if it had come, say, you know, in the first 10 episodes. I might have liked it a little better. I don't dislike it. It's definitely not an episode that I would be like, oh, I hate this episode. But yeah, so I don't know if my opinion changed on the episode when I was watching it and making notes, but it definitely. I started to realize a little more why I had the opinion, if that makes sense. Mm-hmm. So, yeah.
Well, like I said, it didn't change my opinion in the sense that I now suddenly think it's a great episode, but it's just not as bad as I thought it was.
Yeah. No, it's not terrible.
It does have issues.
Yeah.
Yeah. It does have issues. We'll get into that. But
yeah.
Anyway, let's go with the TV guide listing for the synopsis. And TV Guide has it written as, at an old California party where the sleuths are working security, a legendary prospector's journal is stolen, and a guest is stabbed to death, whose dying words spark a fevered gold rush, led by Laura, Steele, and Murphy.
Yep, pretty on the nose.
That pretty much hits it, yeah. So, we start out, costume party. Oh, man. Oh, it's an old California costume party. And of course, as the synopsis says, the agency's been hired to guard actually her entire collection of old California artifacts, of which the journal is one piece. And so they're told it's a costume party, and they let Steele pick the costumes. And apparently he forgot to mention, didn't pay attention, whatever it was, that it was old California. And so he picks a Sherlock Holmes costume for himself.
Of course he does.
Murphy. Yeah, yes, of course he does. Murphy is a clown. Of course Steele picks that for Murphy, right? Yeah. Yeah. Or that's Steele's opinion of him. And then Laura as a bunny rabbit. And I just have to wonder, did he deliberately choose the clown for Murphy just to embarrass him in front of Laura, or is he still working on humiliating Murphy as much as possible simply for the sheer pleasure of it? Now, I know that he said, well, this was all they had left. I don't believe it. It's a costume store.
Quite literally the same comment that I had. I wrote, he claims it was the only costumes that were left, but I'm not too sure about that. I said, this seems right up earlier Steele's alley of trying to get a rise or reaction out of Murphy and having his fun teasing Laura. So yes. Yeah, this is a Myrtle Groggins situation right here. He thought it would be funny, as you know, to put her in a rabbit costume. He thought it would be hilarious to make Murphy dress up like a clown. And of course he's Sherlock Holmes, because he's always impersonating a detective. So
sure. That's his life now.
Literally, it's not even a costume at this point. So
I think he really kind of reveals that it was a deliberate choice when he kind of rubs in the whole thing by saying, the choice of one's costume is often determined by the true style of the inner man. Yeah, okay, now we know you deliberately chose the clown for Murphy.
Murphy looks fit to kill him. And I gotta say, though, here's one thing that I did notice, okay? Murphy looks fit to kill him, but at the same time, his clown makeup is flawless.
Oh, great.
So he clearly committed to the costume, right? Like, he didn't have to do the makeup. But this thing, he then reminds Murphy that if something is worth doing, it's worth doing right. Right. And so Murphy puts the nose on. But like, Murphy could have just put the costume on and didn't bother with the makeup. But he probably sat there. Makeup like that takes hours. Murphy's committed to the bit.
Well, you know, like they say, anything worth doing is worth overdoing. Yeah. Now, Steele comments to Laura about how she looks rather fetching in a cottontail. Is that a Playboy Bunny joke?
I wondered that too, because they did go to.
Must be psychotic. Thinking the same lines.
Oh, definitely, definitely psychotic. But I mean, they did go to the Devil's Playground, which was clearly supposed to be the Playboy Mansion. So I don't know if it was, but it kind of seems like a wink for sure.
Yeah. Yeah. Oh, and then, of course, after they realize that they are totally inappropriately dressed, Steele makes the comment about, well, let's just try and fit in and not draw attention to ourselves.
Yeah. It's like, she's a literal rabbit.
It reminds me of the Batman 66 TV series when Batman would tell someone that he and Robin didn't want to draw attention to themselves while wearing tights and capes, you know, in the middle of, say, a swank dinner party or some such thing. It's just
dressed as a bat.
Yes. So anyway, so Sylvia Kilbride, who had hired them, approaches them and congratulates Steele on his choice of a Sherlock Holmes costume, commenting that it was quite clever of him to know that Sir Arthur Conan Doyle, the creator of Sherlock Holmes, once visited California.
Yeah.
But she doesn't quite understand the significance of the rabbit and the clown. It's like, okay, let's just make something up on the spot to justify it. Sir Francis Drake's childhood fantasy was to be a clown. Yeah. And of course, Kit Carson often survived in the wilderness on nothing but rabbit. Well, that last half I could buy. I couldn't, you know, find any total documentation of that, but I mean, it makes sense that that's a possibility. Sir Francis Drake's childhood fantasy of being a clown. I'm not buying that one. And I didn't find anything to prove it either.
No, and I Googled it, embarrassingly enough. Honestly,
I came up with nothing.
My Google searches lately for this podcast, I'm on a watch list. I'm almost certain of it. You know? Like somebody's going to be like, okay, that's either a writer, a podcaster, or a psychopath. There's no, there's no middle ground.
There's no in between. No, I hear you. Well, off topic, but kind of related to what you just said, I do a podcast for White Collar. And yeah, I get into some really bizarre searches for that too.
I can imagine.
So if you think you're on a watch list, hey, you're looking at the guy.
Like, oh.
But anyway, as they're having this conversation, there is a sudden scream. A man dressed as Zorro has attacked an old prospector, stabbing him with a sword. The phantom Zorro escapes, and of course our intrepid trio rushes to the prospector just in time to hear him say, 80 loons, just before he dies.
Yeah. Now, I mean, as a Canadian, I'm very tempted to think he was talking about our dollar coin, the loony.
Okay.
But that wasn't a so we... Our dollar coin is called a loonie.
Story time.
Yeah, our dollar coin is called a loonie, literally because it has a loon on the back. And our $2 coin is a toonie because we have no creativity. And it, I'm serious. It has a polar bear on the back. So, you know, but it can't be our Looney that he was talking about, because our Looney did not come into being until 1989. So not it.
Okay. Well,
if he said 80 loons, he'd only have 80 bucks. That's all I'm saying.
Oh, and that's Canadian. Yeah. Which
it's like, is probably what, worth 500 American.
Yeah. And from what I understand, it's also worth more than the Australian dollar. But anyway, Miss Kilbride next is seen in Laura's office, and they are, of course, discussing the events of the party from the previous night. This is later the following day. And Laura says, we've run an inventory on your collection, and it's all good to go. And she says, yeah, except for the journal. Laura's like, what journal? And Miss Kilbride says that, oh, passive-aggressive much here? While you guys were so ably protecting my collection of California artifacts, some scoundrel broke into my library and stole the journal of a prospector named Arnold. Yeah, passive?
Very, very. I'm also amused that she told Laura it must have been hard to run in those bunny shoes.
This woman, okay, she... yeah, she's already not really a nice person.
No.
And it only gets better from here.
Yeah.
So anyway, Laura suggests that, the journal was just a curiosity. Or no, actually, Miss Kilbride does. It was just a curiosity. They were scratchings of a nomad, nothing more, certainly nothing of value. And Laura suggests, well, you know, maybe there was something that somebody did consider killing for in that journal or having to do with that journal. So we already set up now that the journal is a focal point. And then we jump to Steele's apartment where he's getting dressed and he's contemplating various books with illustrations of Lou, the bird, not the coin.
Not the Canadian dollar.
Yes. And he wonders if it's some sort of code and he references the movie 39 Steps.
Yep.
So there's a movie reference there. And then as he's getting dressed, he gets a phone call from a man who says, if you want to know about those 80 loons, you'll meet me at the Macau bar. So then we have this setup, which comes into play here in just a little bit. Then we jump over to the Marietta's used car lot. Laura and Murphy are at the lot looking through cars, and Murphy's filling her in on some details. The dead man's name was Dan Curtin. He was a drifter in and out of jail. Nothing interesting about him except his eyes. One green, one brown. And then Murphy spots the car that they're there looking for. It's a car that, according to the license plate number, was on the security log sheets indicating that it was driven by somebody to the party the previous night. They are approached by Felix Murrieta. He gives them the usual used car salesman schmooze, telling them what a great car the LTD they zeroed in on is, and
fantastic man of taste.
He's trying to sell them. Yes. And quite frankly, the LTDs of that era were just kind of boxes. Yeah. But anyway, Laura asks about being at Sylvia Kilbride's party the previous night, and then Marietta becomes very defensive.
Yeah.
When Laura points out that, hey, you were an uninvited guest at a party where a man was murdered, Murrieta says, well, he didn't have anything to do with that.
And he also drops his Spanish accent. The minute Laura points out that they're not there to buy the car, he drops the Spanish accent. You bunny.
I did not notice that.
Yeah, no, he comes out full Spanish accent. The second they kind of reveal they're not there to buy a car, he just...
Are you the bunny rabbit?
Yeah, and you the jerk in the Sherlock Holmes outfit.
So anyway, he says he was there at the party because he was interested in old California. His family's been in California a long time, and he just wanted to take a look at the exhibit. And when Laura and Murphy press him about not just being there, but also ask him what costume he was wearing, he kicks him off the lot.
Yep.
Unless you really want to buy the LTD.
Unless you want the LTD.
So then we jump to the Macau bar, where Steele is wearing a pea coat, a red turtleneck, and smoking something that has a name, but
it's a cigarillo.
It's like a cigarillo. Okay. Yep. Cross between a cigarette and a cigar. Yeah.
Yeah. And I'm embarrassed to say I know that because in my 20s, we went through a phase where, you know, at parties, people would bring cigarillos, and I don't smoke cigarettes and I don't smoke cigars, but for some reason we thought ourselves very sophisticated to have cigarillos and pass one around. So Yeah.
Were they funny cigarettes?
No. Oh, well, there were those two, but in this case, no.
But you deny all knowledge and responsibility of those. Yes, well, I understand.
I've got some funny stories.
Deniable plausibility. Yeah. So, hey, I got it right.
Yep.
So, Steele is playing pool with a guy who has taken exception to him, calling him a hustler and a cheat. Yeah. And he doesn't like the fact that Steele talks funny. Yeah. So, we got a great visual gag here where Steele lines up a shot and takes it, making sure the cue ball takes a hop.
Yep.
Right into the man's crotch.
Ouch.
Ouch, yeah. And Steele offers an insincere apology. And at that time, he's approached by a stranger who says, 80 loons. And the stranger directs Steele to the men's room. And once in the men's room, the man pulls a huge knife and pins Steele to the back of the door with it.
Yep.
And the man warns Steele, he says, what you're looking for belongs to me. Stay out of it or you and your bunny rabbit friend can get hurt. And yes, if you haven't seen the episode, the actual Remington Steele episode, and you're just following along with us and getting ready to watch it after you listen to us, yes, they refer to all of the main characters by their costumes from this party.
Throughout the episode. Throughout the entire episode. Keep calling Murphy a clown. And which actually I think is probably the best one because clown can be used as an insult. So it has sort of a double meaning throughout the entire episode. Like, oh, are you the clown that was the clown kind of thing?
Yep.
Yeah. His outfit is weird. Is it... I find it very strange. Yeah, Steele's outfit. Like, I'm not sure what that was. That bar is supposed to be sort of a dive, correct?
I'm presuming it's on the waterfront.
Yeah.
At least that's the impression I get.
Is that his best attempt at dressing down? Because it's not really working.
I wouldn't say dressing down. I would say it's his best attempt at trying to dress appropriate. Or what he thinks is appropriate to the location, but his idea of what is appropriate is probably based on movies, which probably have very little to do with reality.
But he still looks like he just walked out of a magazine. I don't think that's quite...
Oh, he always does.
Yeah. But the thing is, we know in his past that he has sort of existed in the underbelly of places before. So it's kind of strange that he went with this very expensive looking coat and weird little turtleneck and then a cigarillo in his mouth that he's not even smoking. It just hangs there. Like, at no point is he even smoking this thing. It's like those toothpicks he was wearing in that episode where he was trying to be Sam Spade.
Yep.
It's another costume.
Yeah. So anyway, after the man threatens Steele and Steele is hanging there, stuck to the back of the door, he leaves with Steele still hanging on the door.
That's a good
visual. Yes, it is. And then the man we come to know is Emmett DeVore opens the door and enters. And as he's doing that, Steele is hanging toes on the floor, trying to walk.
He gets shoved into the wall.
And then it's a great, again, Brosnan should do more comedy.
Oh, yeah, for sure.
He does because he is very good at it.
Such a good
And this is another example. Yes. So with DeVore in there, he starts describing himself to Steele. And this is interesting because he describes himself to Steele as a sea captain, poet, barrister, retired. Which I've got a comment about here in just a little bit.
Yep.
He brags that he cleverly hid himself under a table until he left. Yeah. Referring to the who's Lou Cody. Cleverly hid himself under the table. Yeah. That's a euphemism I'm a chicken.
Coward.
Yeah. Yeah. So he calls Lou Cody a miserable lowlife bum who claims to own DeVore's claims. Oh, no, that didn't make sense.
Dubs.
Yeah, he claims to own what DeVore claims is rightfully his. Yeah. And he clarifies it's not loons, it's doubloons, as in gold doubloons. So, oh, these names get real confusing because yeah. nobody's who they say they are. Mr. Steele, I'm glad you are who you say you are. And we jump to the Kilbride Mansion where Laura and Murphy have arrived, and Murphy is pleased that the intrepid Mr. Steele hasn't stuck his big nose into this case yet.
He's already
there. Miss Kilbride meets them at the door. Yes. She meets them at the door, invites them in, saying Steele is already here. And Murphy is not happy. I mean, you can just see it in his face.
Yep.
So Steele introduces Laura and Murphy to Captain Emmett DeVore, soldier, philanthropist, archaeologist, CPA, retired. Is he padding his resume? Because earlier he claimed to be a sea captain, a poet, and a barrister. Now it's soldier, philanthropist, archaeologist, and CPA. He's either padding his resume or he can't keep a job.
Or he's lying completely, right? Because we know he's not even Emmett DeVore, but yes, it's very amusing that every time he introduces himself, and these are like not just one profession, right? Philanthropists, mm-hmm. well, that's not really a profession, but soldier, archaeologist, CPA, but all of them, he's retired, so.
And the thing is, none of them have anything in common pretty none much with whatsoever. Anything else. So no. It's not like he's creating this mythology that he had this series of jobs all in the same type of industry or whatever. It's just, hey, I'm going to throw darts at a dartboard that has all these different jobs at it. And whatever it hits, that's what I was. So when asked, I've got my names. I know I got my names mixed up.
This episode is really confusing for names. And I will say that maybe one of the things that makes this episode, I don't dislike it, but one of the reasons why it's not my most favorite episode ever is I have trouble keeping track of everybody, especially towards the end when they all start switching identities and I'm just like, okay, what? Who's who they say they are?
You almost need a bulletin board with little
lines, one of those, that meme where the guy's got the string and he's pointing to all of it. Yeah, mm-hmm. exactly.
So anyway, DeVore admits that he was an uninvited guest at the previous evening's soiree. Miss Kilbride says that Captain DeVore had read in the papers that she had Arnold Dobbs's journal. So he came to protect his interest, which was the journal, which has something to do with the gold doubloons. And so Steele clarifies to Laura and Murphy that DeVore's interest is the doubloons, not necessarily the journal. And Miss Kilbride explains that the 18th century Toledo Mint doubloons, and that DeVore had a single coin from that mint, one of those doubloons, and that it was worth well over $1,000 just by itself. DeVore says that Arnold Dobbs, who was his partner, figured it would take at least four burrows to bring the rest of the gold out of wherever it was. And DeVore says that Dobbs staked him on his expedition, which turned out to be a bit of a fiasco.
Yeah.
But in exchange, he was given a document guaranteeing him one half of the treasure of the San Jacintos. Miss Kilbride suggests that the treasure probably consists of the doubloons, which had been robbed from a Spanish caravan by the Murrietas in 1787. DeVore calls the Murrietas a family of banditos, saying that they had terrorized the state for generations with their thieving and murdering, and heaven knows what they're up to now. And Murphy says, well, they own a used car lot.
They've stooped that low,
have they?
This is good. Oh. This is good. And his Irish accent is so, it's quite the.
So let me get this straight. Yeah, it is. It's a good, he does it well. Yeah. But let me get this straight. In the criminal hierarchy, people who are thieves are more socially acceptable than people who are murderers, and thieves and murderers are more socially acceptable than people who sell used cars.
Well, you know, this tracks.
Get out of it.
This totally tracks. It's kind of like, you know, have you seen Firefly? The show?
Yeah, oh yeah.
So you know, it's kind of like in that episode where Shepherd Book tells Mal that if he takes advantage of Saffron, that he'll go to this kind of special hell reserved for child molesters and people who talk at the theater. It's people like it's kind of, you know, people that talk at the theater. I could see it because, you know, you just want to like, reminded me of that. They yeah. stooped that low.
Slap, get up and slap them. So Laura informs DeVore that Felix Murrieta Jr. was at the party the previous evening, and DeVore declares that Murrieta was no doubt after his gold, and that it wouldn't surprise him if that Murrieta was the one who killed Dan Curtin, who was their victim. Mm-hmm. Laura asks DeVore what he knows about Curtin, and DeVore suddenly starts stumbling and stuttering over himself and has trouble talking,
yep.
just kind of like I'm doing right now. And he says that, well, Dan Curtin was a liar and a thief, and that he, DeVore, had always had a great disliking for him. And Murphy asks enough to kill him. And DeVore says, well, if he was a murderer, he wouldn't have made a great detective like Remington Steele a partner in the claim in exchange for services, of course. And Laura is not happy.
No, she's not.
She calls for a private meeting of the minds.
Ethics.
And as they leave the room, we can see that Murphy's not happy either.
No.
And then an alarm goes off. That happens a couple of times in this episode. So they start to do something and then something interrupts them. So the alarm goes off. Murphy, Laura, and Steele all take off toward the source of the alarm, with Murphy following a black clad figure outside and down a set of stairs before catching a woman who looks at Steele and Laura, because they've just arrived on the scene, and she asks, will somebody get this clown off me?
Which is that clown
pun. Clown joke.
Right, the double entendre about the clown.
Yep.
Poor Murphy. Well,
back at the agency offices, Steele is manhandling the woman into his office. A little rough there. When she says she was only at the Kilbride Mansion doing research, Laura says, oh, yeah, really? Research? What kind of research requires you to break and enter into somebody's home? And she says, well, she's a freelance writer working on the Zorro murder, but that Sylvia Kilbride wouldn't talk to her on the phone. And then when the I've got a reasonable explanation tactic doesn't work, she tries the pity tactic, saying, oh, she's really ashamed of herself. Oh, it was such a wrong thing to do. And Laura, of course, sees right through it and tells the woman so to her face. Not bad. Schoolgirl guilt, stammering and blushing.
Yeah, she says, my father taught me not to lie. He was a minister. It's like, okay, that's a bit much. Yeah.
Well, that proves it then.
Yeah, exactly.
Right? I mean, after all, no one would lie about telling the truth, would they? Especially if their father was a minister, nobody would lie about that,
no,
would they?
No, of course not.
As Laura's, she's not buying any of it. She's no dummy.
No.
So she says, well, you know what? Let's have your minister father post your bail for you. So, okay, she's caught, but she is still trying to play games. She admits that she lied about being Lois Grubbombs.
Grubbombs? I think it was.
Whatever.
What a name.
I listened to her say that name several times, and I still can't.
Yeah, it was confusing.
Still can't pronounce it. Yeah. So she lied about that. She lied about her father being a minister, and she lied about lying.
Yeah.
Or she lied about not lying. And then she continues to sell her story by trying to work some flattery on Steele by saying, you're good, Mr. Steele. You saw right through me, didn't you? God, you're good. Yeah.
This is another one of those. Laura is not stupid. Laura sees the situation as it is, but Steele is another story. She turns on the charm, the sex appeal. He's an idiot. He eats it right up.
Yeah. I mean, and it couldn't be more obvious.
No.
I mean,
no.
Laura sees it just straight away, but Steele just seems to be falling for it. So she finally ends up telling something that seems to be closer to the truth, if only because her previous stories were so blatantly and transparently lies.
Yeah.
She says her name is Kitty Dobbs, Arnold Dobbs's illegitimate daughter. But then she still goes back into the sob story,
you know, like of the North.
Something out of a bad movie. And she keeps trying to entangle Steele. She describes Dobbs' relationship with her mother as a month of passion in the gold fields of Alaska. Said he loved her, sent her money when he could. And when he struck it rich, he promised to make her a queen. And of course, as she's been talking, she's gotten up and she's moving closer to Steele.
Yeah.
Starting to, you know, almost rub up against him like a cat or something. And
well, her name is Kitty.
She tries to.
Yeah. I mean, I'm just saying.
I walked right into that one, didn't
you,
I?
Yeah, you did. You do it.
She tries to elicit some pity and a sense of protectiveness from Steele when she says that now she lives in a one bedroom in Canoga Park.
Yeah.
What is that? Is that? Do I hear the world's smallest violin playing a mournful song?
Yeah, Laura standing there rolling her eyes, just like, oh, dear Lord. Like, she's at this point just kind of just, what an idiot, you know?
Yeah. And she says, I appeal to you, Mr. Steele. The doubloons are rightfully mine. Look into my eyes. Among the Eskimos from the great north where I was spawned.
Spawned.
Green is the color of honesty. And then she gets real visual with her words. All I ask is the chance to stand before you, stripped bare, naked with the truth. Could she possibly be any more obviously suggestive without coming right out and propositioning Steele?
He's not thinking with his brain, so that's worth pointing out. Well, it's also worth pointing out.
He's thinking with his head, but...
Yeah.
Yeah.
Obviously, and this, like... I mean, this being a show in the 1980s, I can forgive the use of the word Eskimo, but I cringe a little when I hear that just because it's...
Well, you know, I did do a couple of looks on the internet. First of all, I didn't find that green is the color of honesty among Eskimos.
No, I didn't find that either.
But I did find that according to the Alaska Native Language Center at the University of Alaska Fairbanks, and I know this from personal experience as being a rideshare driver,
have to defer to.
There are Native Alaskans who do still refer to themselves as Eskimos, in part because the word Inuit, which seems to translate into English as people, wasn't part of the Yupik languages of Alaska and Siberia. Huh. Additionally, the Alaska Native Language Center indicates that linguists believe that the word Eskimo actually came from the French word Esquimau, I'm probably butchering that pronunciation, meaning one who knits snowshoes.
Huh.
Which is the highly precise way that the Arctic tribes and peoples built their winter footwear, tightly weaving or netting sinew from caribou and other animals across a wooden frame, of which I think I still have a pair of my dad's snowshoes around here somewhere. Hmm. So
okay, well, I don't live in Alaska, so I'm going to have to defer to your knowledge in that respect.
Well,
but yeah,
this is not my knowledge. This is from the Alaska Native Language Center. But yeah, there are still some people who find the word offensive. But I have had natives that I've picked up, given rides to, who refer to themselves as Eskimo. So it seems to be one of those words that, depending on who you are,
yeah,
and what
I was
your
gonna say, it's
background kind of, with it is.
It's kind of like, you know, if you look at the word Indian as well, right? How you'll still hear some use it here in Canada, and I'm sure in the U.S. as well. Mm-hmm. And, you know, it's not my place to say whether or not they can or can't, but, you know, the overall term that is accepted here is First Nations, if you're talking about anyone who's not Métis or Inuit. Anyone who is, we use Indigenous to sort of put a whole blanket over it, but First Nations, Métis, Inuit are the three sort of known groups, and then there's subgroups within that. But, yeah, you can't really, I think the thing is she's not a spawn of the north. I think we
and even Laura addresses that when Murphy walks in and asks about Kitty's story. Laura says, spawn of the north, I smell
something
fish in
fishy.
The air.
But she gives her, I mean, Kitty turns and gives her this smug look that just says that she's got him in her clutches.
Well, and not only that, but she's gotten under Laura's skin.
Yeah.
So she's gotten a double victory out of it. She's got Steele kind of wrapped around her finger and Laura irritated. So yeah. Double win for her. Well, Murphy comes up with another one of those. Yes. Murphy comes in and I already said Murphy came in, but he's got a report of another one of the uninvited license plates that appeared at Miss Kilbride's party the evening before. Somebody named Chance McCormick, a professional gold hunter. And Murphy says he uses, and we have a hard cut, and we see a lab full of computers. And Laura finishes that statement by saying, computers. And Steele starts down a path of revealing something about his past. And he says, for me, McCormick's gold hunting computers lack the human obsession.
Yeah.
And Laura says, you mean the obsession of men like your Captain DeVore? And of course, Steele tries to excuse the arrangement that he made with DeVore being a partner in the claim by saying that, well, it's just a way to keep tabs on him. My gold hunting days, they're in the past.
Sure, Steele, and, sure.
Laura, you're not really sure if he's telling the truth or not, though, is the thing.
Yeah, and I go back and forth on this.
Yeah, your mysterious past includes gold, or includes prospecting, and I was hobby, nothing more. So, yeah, I mean, is he serious, or...
It's a question mark, because sometimes he'll say things that I think we can clearly write off as fiction, i.e. playing, what was it, polo with...
Polo with Charles.
Yeah, that one, I think, you know, but then he'll say something like this, and it's conceivable. Like, you can imagine that this is something he might have done. We don't know where his travels took him, so maybe? Question mark?
So, anyway, as they're conversing, they're walking along, and they come to a door marked restricted, and they are greeted by the mechanical voice asking for their names. Steele, not using his inside voice, which is what so many people do when they're talking on cell phones, because obviously you have to holler in order for the person on the other end of the phone to hear you because they're so far away.
And then the other end of the other person's on speaker, so you hear everything they're saying too, and you're just like, oh God, really? Like,
not only that, but you hear.
Yeah. The worst is so when it's anyway. In a bathroom and they're on the toilet and they're talking on their phone, and you're just like, what? Why? Why? I don't understand. Anyway.
We've had this conversation.
We
before.
Have had this conversation. It keeps so coming anyway, back.
Yes. Like a bad meal. So Steele announces himself and Laura, and the computer admonishes Steele by saying, well, you don't have to shout. I'm not deaf. Sorry. My dad coming out there.
You sounded like my husband for deaf. It's a Scottish way of saying it.
The computer admonishes. Oh, no. Yeah, I said that. Laura's a bit unnerved with all of this. She says that with all these machines, it's like, and Steele concludes her thoughts with the word metropolis, to which the computer promptly supplies the attribution.
Yeah.
Metropolis, directed by Fritz Lang, UFA Studios, Berlin, 1926. Sorry. Yeah. And the synopsis being the great mass of inferior human workers becomes dominated by superior machines. And
I think the computer's editorializing it slightly.
Yes. Artificial intelligence, anybody? Yeah. Steele challenges the computer to name the actors, which he does.
Yeah.
It does. I don't know.
You've assigned the computer humanity. This is how the machines overtake us.
That's right. So next we're on the inside of the computer lab, and they chance upon Chance McCormick, who's focusing on his computer displays and is totally, totally oblivious to their arrival. Steele calls McCormick's name several times, attempting to gain his attention. Without any luck, Laura tells Steele, let me. She steps up behind McCormick, cups her hands to her mouth to focus the sound of her voice, and says, gold. And of course, McCormick's head instantly whips around.
Yep.
And he's not amused by the joke.
Yeah, this guy is special.
How do you mean that?
He speaks like a computer himself. And I mean, I know
noticed that. And even the sound of the voice of the computer sounds a bit like him.
Yeah, you wonder if he actually programmed the voice commands, right? Mm-hmm. Because it does, you're right, it sounds like him. And we know he's the murderer, but even without that part of things, he's an odd duck.
You know? Oh, yes. He's definitely been hanging around his computers for too long, that's for sure. Yeah. So he addresses Steele and Laura by name, stating that his computer, his Alpha 7500, told them that they were on his way. And Steele comments that Alpha 7500 sounds like a radioactive dog food.
I like that.
And McCormick brags that it's the best little data exchange system west of IBM. And he states that he, again, assigning humanity to the computer, monitored their conversations as they were coming in. So does that mean McCormick imagines his computer as being a living thing?
I definitely think it's possible because, again, he seems to think the computer is more human than the people around him in a way,
mm-hmm.
which is.
Yeah, he's definitely got issues with computers. That's yeah. for sure. So anyway, he says that they foolishly believe that he killed Dan Curtin with his Zorro sword. And when Steele asks if McCormick knew Dan Curtin, McCormick says, "I know everyone who's anyone in the gold business. Dan Curtin was a scavenger, a dirty fingernailed gold digger," which Steele rightly comments is an odd vilification, considering his own profession. And he does seem to draw a distinction between himself and folks like Dan Curtin, because he says, yes, it's a profession. And he used the term dirty fingernailed gold digger, which
it
indicates he's got a different view of their approaches. And maybe they did have different approaches because obviously he's using computers.
He doesn't want us to get figuratively and literally, he doesn't want to get dirty.
Yeah. He explains that he's rented himself a piece of an Italian Earth survey satellite. It sends radio beams through the ground right back to him, reporting on the presence of copper, tin, uranium, and the big G, gold. He acknowledges that he is working on trying to find the doubloons from the San Jacinto. I know I'm butchering that name.
San Jacinto? Jacinto?
San Jacinto. Yes, thank you. It's been one of those days, what can I say? And I've never been good at foreign languages anyway.
I mean, my French is terrible.
My apologies to everybody.
We get 9 years of French in Canada, and I can remember the swear words and how to find the library. And that's about it, right? Like,
well, isn't that what most people do? They learn a foreign language, and the first thing they want to learn is the swear words, and that's the only thing that they can remember.
Well, la bibliothèque. I can do that, but like, yeah, I can order a beer in Spanish. You know, that's about the extent of my Spanish. So,
so as they're talking, Steele points out to McCormick that he doesn't seem to be having much success in his computerized endeavors. And Laura points out that despite all the technology he employs, McCormick is still essentially in the same boat as everyone else. He needs the scratchings of an old prospector to find the gold.
Yeah, he doesn't like that.
That does it.
Yeah.
McCormick has had it with them. He instructs one of his minions to show Sherlock and the bunny rabbit out. This interview is terminated. And this is where I have it written down. He says this in a voice that sounds like it could have come from the computer.
Yeah, it does.
So, yeah. I think maybe the, what was it? Star Trek M1, the ultimate computer?
Yeah. Yeah.
Where he programmed it with his own voice and personality. Yeah, that's what this reminds me of.
Yep.
Anyway, we have a small, short scene where we see Steele at his desk. He's called Felix Murrieta. And we have a one-sided phone call in which Murrieta apparently starts trying to sell Steele a car. Again, got to sell those cars. Steele's finally able to get to the point. He has news. They've recovered the missing journal. And I kind of note here that I wrote because one-sided conversations are often done poorly.
They're rushed.
And
I'm not kidding.
We're psychotic. Brosnan does this conversation really well because he gives an appropriate amount of space for the imagined other end of the conversation, which is something so many people don't do. And I can understand directors are in a hurry. They don't want the dead space, but
are you reading my note? Right.
It's important.
It says, Brosnan does an excellent job of speaking as if he is having a conversation on the phone. He pauses for an appropriate amount of time, which often people don't do on TV. So it looks fake. That is what I wrote. Dude.
You know,
it's creepy.
And like I said, I understand some directors are in a hurry. Okay, we've only got X number of minutes. We got to get as much of this script in as we can. We don't want to have to edit it down. But it's nice when somebody lets a scene have the natural air to breathe that it needs. The Office was one show that did that very well. And in fact, in the episode Booze Cruise, I think they said there was something like almost 30 seconds of silence as two characters, Pam and Jim, stood there by the rail of the ship. Total silence, not a word spoken. So, yeah, it's nice when people let the scene have the breathing room that it needs.
Yeah,
so,
and this is...
Well done, Pierce.
I have to say, too, Stephanie does a good job of it in other places, because especially when she's talking to her mother on the phone and she's trying to, like, get a word in edgewise, and she's very convincing that way. But yes, I wrote down the exact same note for this, and I find that very creepy, but obviously we're on the same wavelength when it comes to, because I'm watching the scene going, yeah, he does look like he's having a real conversation, and usually it's not the case. They pick up, they go, uh-huh, okay, thanks, bye, and then they hang up, and you're like, I'm sorry, that's not how phones work.
Yeah. Oh, and then they give you a summary of the conversation. Yeah, and
which was
just
a
keeps
long...
going on and on and on. And, well, you did all that in 10 seconds?
How?
Yeah. Anyway, next we are in the outer office. And no, we're in Laura's office.
Yeah.
And Laura and Murphy are talking. And we learn that the purpose of Steele's phone calls, the one that we just heard, was one of several that he made. Steele had called all the suspects and told them that he and Murphy and Laura had found the journal, put it in their office safe. And so now Steele expects the innocent parties to try and steal it, but not the guilty party. And Laura points out that it does make a, as she says, peculiar kind of sense, because the guilty party already has it.
Yeah.
And yeah, there's some validity to that, although a smart crook would still go ahead and make the attempt, I would think.
I would think too. This harkens back as well, like coming on the heels of Vintage Steel, this kind of feels a little redundant in the sense that this is similar to what they did in the woods with Harry's body. So it's not quite the same, but it's very similar. And I also noticed this is one of the things that felt a little bit regressive. I can't talk either today, where Murphy says, you know, what's his trust quotient on this one, Laura? And Laura responds with, well, about the same as any other case. And I think that's an interesting response.
Bad, huh?
Well, you could take that one of two ways. You could actually, I think Murphy takes it in a negative way, but we've seen Laura start to develop a trust in him. So in that respect, I think she's sort of brushing Murphy off when she says that, because it basically puts the burden on him to interpret it. Whereas Laura's kind of like, well, it's the same as anything else. Like, she doesn't see anything more or less trustworthy in Steele for this case, regardless of the fact that he's claiming to have been a gold prospector at one point. So, I think it's an interesting exchange.
That's what happens right before this part of the conversation you're talking about, which I think is part of the reason why Murphy's response is what it is.
Yeah.
Because he says that when Laura says he does have experience in gold hunting, we see the first signs of gold fever in Murphy when he very intensely and defensively says, I thought as much. Did you see the way his eyes lit up when DeVore started talking about the gold?
Yeah.
And so he's starting to get it, and he's seeing it in Steele, right or wrong. He's seeing it in Steele, or thinks he's seeing it in Steele. So
does Steele have
that kind of sets up?
Does Steele have gold? Like, I don't know. I don't really. To me, he doesn't seem any more or less interested in finding it than he does any other finder's fee.
Right.
Like he
really doesn't
to find it, but.
Well, a finder's fee, or just because it's gold and it's worth
just
a lot.
Gold.
But yeah, he doesn't get obsessive like Murphy seems to ultimately.
Yeah.
But as Murphy's doing this, did you notice what Laura's response is? She leans back further in her chair.
Yeah.
She's putting more distance between her and Murphy, because maybe she's starting to see Murphy's not handling this well.
No, and this is maybe why it feels a bit regressive, because, again, we're coming off of two episodes the last one Murphy wasn't even in, and Steele in the news, Murphy was in and had a really, you know, he had some really good moments, right? He busted up his arm trying to get through the door, and when you get that big final moment where Laura is watching her hero reveal himself to be a killer, Murphy's arm is around her, he's comforting her. We have this almost like understanding that he's not got a shot with her, but he's still her friend. And now he's back to the old, we can't trust him, he's after the gold. And it just, I think it would make more sense if the episode was earlier in the season.
And that kind of since we're going there now, that kind of addresses the problem. One of the problems that I had with this episode is that Murphy seems a bit out of character.
Yeah.
And part of it is because, as you're saying, it does seem to be a throwback to earlier in the season as far as his attitude towards Steele and such. So I think also his gold fever, the way it's handled, is a little bit off character. But
yeah, it doesn't.
Yeah, I think it's all tied together. It's all tied together.
Did you actually look up whether or not gold fever, as they position it, is a real thing? Because I tried.
No, I did not. It's certainly not. It's not a fever brought on by a virus or bacteria or anything like that.
No, I meant like I was looking up to see if there was a psychological obsession that people could develop that like similar to what happens with Murphy. And all I could come up with were a bunch of historical articles and things like that about specific gold rushes and how people would flock to these areas because gold had been spotted or supposedly had been spotted, but nothing that basically said that your personality could change on a dime at the prospect of something shiny. So like, this is where
shiny.
Hey, I get it. I like shiny things.
All the Firefly fans out there are just rejoicing that we use the word shiny.
There's several Firefly references now. but yeah, I think this is where they create this theory of like becoming a different person and willing to, you know, beg, borrow, and steal for gold. And that
isn't that an episode title?
Yes, actually, it is. There's no gold in that one, though.
Just being goofy today.
Yeah. It's a goofy episode.
I think you're right. I think you're right. I don't think that there is anything that's going to change a person's personality on a split of a dime. Split of a dime? Drop of a dime. Drop of a hat. I don't there know what I'm saying. Yes. I mean, obviously, if somebody has a physical injury to their head, that can cause that.
Sure.
But in terms of what people ascribe as gold fever, it's really just a progression into an obsession.
Yes.
You know, they start out as normal people. Yeah. They start developing this interest in something. They start becoming more deeply interested, and it starts becoming an obsession.
Like, you know, Chance
and it's
McCormick.
One of those things that, yeah. And it could be anything. It doesn't have to be gold. It could be,
well, you
know, yeah, cuddle bunnies or cuddle buddies.
Squishmallows.
Mine's sorry, impossible reference. What's yours?
There are these little stuffed things. Like they're like these little rounded, I don't know, they're called squishmallows. And they're really squishy and they're very popular with kids right now. My daughter's room is currently breeding them. Like they're just multiplying to the point where every time she sees something like a stuffy, we've told her that unless she gets rid of them, we're gonna have to move. Because we have no more space. We're going to end up on an episode of Hoarders. So, like, this is... but, yeah, like, I get what you're saying. Anything can become a full-on obsession if you let it. It's one of those things where it ceases to be a hobby and becomes an obsession when it starts to rule your life and ruin your relationships. And I almost wonder, when we say it's out of character for Murphy, I agree that he seems to turn so quickly, quote unquote, almost like he's bitten by a gold obsessed vampire. But like, is this really completely out of his personality? Because he's quite obsessed with and possessive of Laura for the entirety of the season. Not obviously in the same way, but he gets very angry and very passionate and very sort of possessive of her whenever it looks like Steele is getting under the wire, so to speak. So I kind of wonder if there was somebody that was likely to become obsessive about something, it doesn't seem all that far-fetched that it would be Murphy. I think it would just have to be presented a little bit more logically, aside from just like, one moment he's fine, the next minute he's, they're after the gold!
Yeah, the way it's presented in this episode, it seems a little sudden and a little bit overboard.
Yeah, very, very overboard.
But, I mean, if Murphy is a secret obsessive personality, then, yeah, what you're saying would be true, potentially. I'm not sure I see that in him, but I can understand what you're coming from.
Yeah,
on that, as far as his
obsessed is the right term, but he's definitely very laser focused when it comes to Laura. Mm-hmm. And even anytime Steele gets into any sort of sphere where it looks like he's winning her affections or winning her trust, then that personality comes out, right? So I don't know. His personality is very, I think, susceptible to something like that. Whereas okay. I don't know that Steele's is, because he's used to chasing after artifacts and paintings and all these sorts of rare collectibles that are worth tons of money all the time. For Steele, money comes and money goes. And yes, he goes after it, but it's not. I mean, let's face it, if Murphy came into what amounted to be tens of thousands of dollars worth of gold doubloons, like, his life is set. He's good. He never has to work a day mm-hmm. again, as opposed to Steele, who is sort of used to money being this ephemeral thing that slips through his fingers and is never quite to be depended on. So I don't think he would set his sights so firmly on this, because for him, it's never a true payday, I don't think. That may be more okay. analysis than this episode warrants, but
anyway. Where were we? Let's see. Back at the office, after Laura and Murphy have this exchange, Steele comes in and whispers that someone is coming. He douses the lights and they open the door so they can watch. And when I see this, it's reminiscent of something from the Three Stooges, where they've got one person stacked on top of the other person, peeking out through a crack of a door. So,
and they do it.
Then
more
we
than
see
once.
What they see. Yes, yes, they do. So we see from their view that somebody's breaking into the obvious. Somebody's breaking into the office, and it's obvious. There, I was going to use that word. I just put it in the wrong place. It's obvious that it's DeVore. And Murphy, of course, expresses astonishment that the plan is actually working. Yeah. And then Steele slips out of the darkened back office. He flips the lights on, and divorcee Steele, and realizing he's been caught, he starts laughing as if it's some sort of a joke or some innocent misunderstanding. And he was really just there to make sure that the journal was safe, safe from anybody who might break into the office and steal it,
From teeth and hands.
Yeah, don't you know?
I keep expecting him to say, they're always after me, Lucky Charms. Like that. I don't know why, but that throughout the entire episode, I kept expecting that. It never happened.
And for our younger viewers, that's a reference to an old, old commercial.
Yeah.
Go look it up on YouTube. Anyway, DeVore tries to leave the office, but Steele wraps his arm around him and says, no, you're not going anywhere, lad. Yeah. So then we have a time jump, and Steele, Murphy, and Laura are, again, in the office, along with Chance McCormick, Kitty Curtin, Felix Murrieta Jr., and DeVore. And Steele announces that Lou Cody is the only one who didn't try to break in and steal the journal. And Murphy is just astounded that the plan actually seemed to work.
Except
and
it didn't.
And, of course, the former, they don't know that.
But you pointed that out.
It did, in the sense
the guilty party did show up, right?
Right. But it did in the sense that everybody broke in to try and get it except one person.
True.
So anyway, the former suspects in turn make various declarations. Cody has the journal. He's gone for the gold. My machete will taste his blood. And the man's a devil and someone should stop him. And of course, Remington isn't sure what to do with their former suspects.
No.
Laura declares, let him go.
Yep.
Let him go. And she directs Murphy to bring Miss Gilbride up to date and tell Steele that she wants him to take her to where he first met Cody. still doesn't think it's a good idea. It's hardly the place for a, and he doesn't get to complete the sentence because Laura cuts him off saying, don't be ridiculous. I'm a private investigator. It's my job to fit in everywhere. Except that, yeah, there are places that every person isn't going to fit in. And Dockside Bar in the 1980s isn't the sort of place where Laura's going to fit in.
I also wrote, but is it? She's terrible at undercover. Like, she's she's not good at it. We've seen this.
That's true. And we see more evidence of it here because she just,
her outfit.
She dresses like a comic book version of a dock worker.
Yeah.
So the man who was earlier playing pool with Steele makes a crude pass at Laura.
Yeah.
Steele suggests that maybe Laura might prefer to wait outside in the car. She dismisses the suggestion, saying, this is Laura Holt, PI. Let's sweat some information out of these turkeys and split.
Yeah, is this her best Sam Spade?
Bad movie dialogue, anybody?
She channeling Steele from, doing her best Sam Spade.
Mm-hmm. Anyway, Steele, well, I guess both of them actually go to the bar and sit down next to Macau, Molly. And Molly starts putting the moves on Steele. Well, big time. Ooh. Telling Laura, we don't get too many lookers in here. Do you mind? This, I said, sure, no problem.
This bothers me on a number of levels. I actually felt very uncomfortable watching this scene. And I know it's supposed to be funny, but I don't know. It just, A, she looks at Laura as if he's not a human being and asks Laura's permission and then just starts like,
hey, can I pet your dog?
Aggressively. Yeah. And then just starts aggressively kissing him. And if, I mean, think about if the genders were reversed, this is really kind of like, and like Steele's sitting there visibly uncomfortable and just like he's covered in lips. It's supposed to be funny. I think maybe this is partly just the situation in general would not be okay reversed. No director in the right mind would do it. B, Brosnan's not doing good physical comedy here. He's doing like, get me the hell out of here. Like that face isn't funny. It's terrifying.
Which could be actually good physical comedy acting on his part, but there may be a little more truth to it than
it's just not acting. I guess what I mean by that is it's not cartoonish like some of his other stuff. He just looks really uncomfortable, so
been there, done that, and we'll just leave that at that. I've been in similar situations, so I hear what you're saying, and it was a little bit uncomfortable, but I tried to focus on the funny part of it.
And because I think my husband's been in similar situations with this too, because he's Scottish, and anytime he wears his kilt anywhere, he has had, I'm not even kidding, women will come up and just pick it up and look underneath to see if what's under the kilt is, so he's obviously always wearing boxers or something because people will look. And it's just like, okay, well, how often does that happen in any other context and be acceptable? Like, hey, are you wearing underwear? Let me check. Like, So, I think that's kind of where that went for me.
So when Molly's finished, she's left Steele's lips covered in her lipstick. Yeah. And Laura asks about Lou Cody. Molly says, well, he left several hours earlier, but for another kiss, she'll tell him where he went. And Steele suggests, well, maybe a shot of bourbon would be a good alternative.
Yeah.
And Molly's disappointed, but apparently not too much because she agrees to the deal.
Yep.
But then we see her sometime later hanging off a Steele, reciting the names of various locales as if considering and then rejecting each one in turn.
Yep.
I'm thinking that there's been more than one shot of bourbon purchased on her behalf.
Definitely.
At this point.
Definitely. More than one shot.
Yeah, she's at least a couple of sheets to the wind.
Yeah.
But with Steele and Murphy, or Steele and Molly occupied, Laura is preparing to play a game of pool with a gentleman. The gentleman that Steele previously encountered. Yep. And do we really believe that she's as ignorant about the game of pool as she's pretending to be?
No, I can't think that she would be. She's playing a ditz, and Laura's not a ditz. Even if she'd never played pool before, she'd know the rules. So,
yeah, and why would she be acting this way since they I mean, it seems like she's maybe trying to manipulate this guy to get some information from him at some point. But I mean, they already know that Molly has the information they need.
Yeah. So
it doesn't really seem like she even needs to get involved in a conversation with anybody anywhere else in that place.
Yeah, so, I agree. It's a weird.
Know, why?
I don't know. It seems like it's just for the gag of her hitting him with the pool cue.
Which she does.
Which she does. And it is funny, you know?
Yes.
So.
And we learned that the end of a pool cue can be just as deadly as...
as the ball itself.
Cue ball itself. So, anyways, all this is happening. The bartender gives out with the last call. Steele buys Molly one last shot in his attempt to pry the information out of her. And after she downs it, it's confirmed that she's been stringing him all along just to get him to pay for her drinks. And she slyly says, he went to Howardville.
Which, doesn't she own the bar?
Yeah.
So, I guess if he's paying for drinks, then she's...
She's making the money from the drinks. Money. If she's drinking it on her own, she's just drinking her profits away.
That's true. That's true.
It's good business.
She's milking them. Yeah, that's true.
Yeah. So next we see Laura and Steele driving through a ghost town. They stop and get out and head into the long abandoned saloon that is there.
Do these towns exist? Like, are these real? Like, in the U.S.? Do these just, like, without, just buildings just left there from, like, the 18th? Mm-hmm. They're just sitting there? No one's done anything with them?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Oh. Huh.
Maybe not a full town anymore. A lot of the buildings would have collapsed and been basically decayed back into the ground. But yeah, in fact, it's gone now, I think. But between here in Anchorage, where I live, and Soldotna and Seward, there's a highway that goes down that direction. And there used to be several abandoned buildings there that were collapsing and falling apart. And they were just sitting out in the middle of this field. And they were just there.
Huh. Yeah. Okay, cool.
Yeah. And in fact, I'm trying to think, I think that there was an actual ghost town in Arizona where they filmed the TV show High Chaparral. And I think one of the reasons that they picked that location was because there were already things there that they could utilize in the show.
Interesting.
So they saved some money on building sets and facades and such.
I mean, I've been to Tombstone, Arizona, but they're using that for tourism now. Like the buildings are maintained because it's people flock there to see.
Right. That but at some point location. In the past, probably they weren't being maintained before it became a tourist trap.
Probably, yeah. That's a good point. I also find it interesting that they seem to have a wardrobe for every occasion, right? Cowboy hats, Western shirts, his little pea coat. You have to wonder if they absolutely need to dress like they came straight out of a Dirty Harry movie. Because, like, is that necessary? I mean, I get the boots may be necessary sort of thing, but, like, the whole... I mean, if he showed up in a suit, that would be weird. But it just... They really commit. Bunny costume... Dockside bar.
I think it's because they don't have any actual experience in these realms. Yeah. You know, they don't have experiences as, you know, living in the Western towns. They don't have experience as dock workers, that sort of thing. And so they dress themselves in what they imagine.
Yeah.
These people would dress like based on you know what they've seen in movies or TV shows or read in books or whatever. And so, yeah, they've taken fiction and imagined that it's reality. Wow,
yeah.
Does that sound like Hollywood? Anyway,
wow, that's meta.
So yeah, I think they're doing it because that's what they think they're supposed to dress like.
That's fair.
Even though it's obvious that it's way over the top.
It is really overdone.
So anyway, we have a time jump. No, we don't have a time jump. I'm skipping ahead in my notes. Sorry about that. Anyway, they get out of the vehicle. They've gone into the saloon, and they're looking around, and they encounter one of the local residents slithering along the floor, and that leads them to some blood on the floor, and they follow the trail of blood along the boardwalk and into another building where they find the body of Lou Cody and the missing journal. Now we have a time jump. It's night, and as Steele is getting ready for the two of them to sack out, Laura's looking around and spots something in the dust on the floor, a green contact lens. Steele says it shouldn't be too difficult to tell which of their suspects fits the prescription when they return to civilization. But would it be a prescription? Couldn't anyone order non-corrective colored contact lenses?
You can.
Without a prescription?
Yeah, you definitely can, because my aunt used to wear them.
That's what I thought.
And you didn't need a prescription to order them. You could buy them in any pharmacy.
Now, I had another question about them, though. Are they translucent or are they solid colored? Because, for example, if you had brown eyes and you put a light green translucent contact over it, it would not look green because the brown of your eyes would be seen through it and it would darken it. Are they solid?
They're colored? Solid color.
And if they are, does that affect your vision?
I don't know. I do know that if people wear, because I've had friends who, when we go to conventions and stuff, they've worn costumes where they've had like black contact lenses, and that can definitely affect your vision. It can make it difficult to see. But I mean, my aunt, like I said, she used to wear colored contact lenses all the time. I didn't know what her actual eye color was from one day to the next, and she didn't seem to have her vision affected by them. I just wonder if maybe how dark it is changes how difficult it is to see. I don't know. I've worn contact lenses. I've worn prescription contact lenses, but never color contacts. So
do we need to talk about the conventions that you go to? What kind they are?
Your typical Klingons walking around, people dressed as Orion slave girls. It's the whole, you think of the nerdiest of nerdy conventions, and there I am. Sometimes in costume.
Anyway, as they're discussing this, after she's found the contact lens, Laura contemplates the sequence of events surrounding Cody's death. Steele comments that cold fever is a frightful disease that can turn an honest, decent man into a treacherous, devious animal bent on destroying anything that stands in his way. Laura asks, experience talking there? And his experience is having watched Treasure of the Sierra Madre, Humphrey Bogart, Walter Houston, Warner Brothers, 1948. But could this be his gold prospecting that he's referring to?
Okay, so actually, did you look up the actual description of the film?
I did not.
Because this is, okay, so you remember how, the episode's escaping me, but like the second episode where they're investigating the episode that was basically North by Northwest, where they're investigating the video company. This is basically that movie, because the description of the movie, it says, in 1925, in the Mexican town of Tampico, labor contractor Pat McCormick recruits Fred C. Dobbs and Bob Curtin, two broke American drifters, as roughnecks to help construct oil rigs for $8 a day. When the project is completed and the men return to Tampico, McCormick skips out without paying them. The two vagrants encounter the old man named Howard in a flop house, a loquacious ex-miner. He talks to them about gold prospecting and the perils of striking it rich. Dobbs and Curtin run into McCormick at a cantina and collect their back wages after a bar fight. When Dobbs hits a small jackpot in the lottery, he, Curtin, and Howard have enough money to buy supplies to go prospecting in the interior. So that's the description of the film. So clearly this episode is based on that movie.
Or inspired by it.
Yeah.
Since they were inspired by it, let's just use the character names.
Use the names. Exactly. And I didn't know that until I was just curious about the movie because I had never seen it. I Googled it and that popped up and I'm, well, this one, that makes sense.
Okay. Yeah.
So, yeah.
It makes sense. Anyway, as Steele's speaking, Laura realizes that he's simultaneously pulling out a bottle of champagne and two glasses just to make things cozy, he says.
Yeah.
And then he suggests that they have a relaxing evening, get some rest, and then, after all, they have to catch a killer in the morning.
Yeah.
Laura has also noticed that Steele has rolled out only one sleeping bag and asks where hers is. And shades of Devil's Island?
Yeah.
Steele makes the excuse that he thought the Jeep was a trifle overcrowded, so he only packed one sleeping bag, and Laura asks, where are you going to sleep?
That is the best line. Oh, that's a shame. You know, where's your bed going to be?
Yeah. And Steele, you know, kind of gets not really offended, but he puts on this attitude and says, the mountain air can freeze a man to death. They must huddle together for warmth. Use the heat of their body to ward off the bitter, chill night air. Uh-huh. And Laura says, well, you know, in the interest of survival.
Yeah.
This is okay, so
plausible deniability right here. We had to snuggle together. There's no other. We could have frozen to death.
Yeah, this is, you know, forcing the issue didn't really seem to work on Devil's Island.
No, but I think she's a little more like their relationship has come a little further since then. So she's kind of used to his antics, and she's like, all right, whatever. Mm-hmm. But this is an interesting trope, though. When you look at fan fiction, this is one of the most common. There's only one bed. They check into a hotel room and gasp, there's only one bed. And, you know, that hijinks ensue. So this is clearly the mm-hmm. writer's going, okay, he's brought one sleeping bag. Now they have to snuggle.
And she doesn't, I mean, she put up a little bit of a fight.
Yeah.
If I can use that word. But she surrendered fairly quickly. Yeah. So, yeah, maybe her attitude is a little different than it was before. So they're sitting there drinking the champagne, huddling together, and Laura manages to sabotage Steele's plans by immersing herself in the pages of the journal, reading about Redneck and Two Eyes.
Yep.
And as she's reading, Steele does begin breaking down her defenses, and she sets the journal aside and allows herself to be drawn in by Steele's seduction.
Yeah, she pauses to ask him how much of a hobby his gold hunting was. His response is pretty funny. You know how I am around shiny objects.
Okay, shiny. Anyway.
Yeah, his flattery, though, it's over the top. Glistening eyes, shimmering lips.
Yeah, like out of a bad romance novel, maybe.
Really bad.
Not that I've read them, but I can imagine.
It's like something out of a Charlotte Knight novel.
Very good.
There we go.
Very good.
He's read them all now. You know that they're in his, he's got a stack of them, and he's working his way down the list because he can't help himself.
Yeah. So anyway, their makeout session is ended with the sound of laughter. The laughter of Emmett DeVore. It's a laughter he's heard before, he says, in the jungles of the Yucatan. The sound of a man made mad with visions of gold. Or was it someone remembering a good joke? So do we ever in the series find out what he was doing in the Yucatan? I don't think so.
No, and again, that could be it's not real. He's just making it up.
Although we do know that he was in South America for a while.
So. True. Yeah.
Anyway, but not hunting gold, as far as we know.
No.
Laura realizes that they may have a problem. She says, well, if DeVore is the killer, then he has a gun. Mm-hmm. Steele, he doesn't see a problem after all. If he's not, why bother him?
Yeah.
Yeah. Interesting logic.
I mean, I kind of find it funny that neither one of them clued into this earlier because a man was murdered. Like,
oh, yeah, somebody was murdered. Like,
yeah, there's a dead dude.
That might be important?
They followed a trail, literal trail of blood, and they're making out next to it. It just felt a little strange. But nobody shot at them, so I guess they thought it was okay to kiss.
Well, I mean, they did it in a morgue, so.
That's true. It's true.
So anyway, making a last-ditch effort to further his seduction, Steele says he wasn't in the mood for sleep anyway, so. He tries, but then he's finally defeated when Laura says, sounds good, you take the first watch. Yeah.
Poor guy. So close.
Yeah. Next morning, Murphy arrives with Miss Kilbride in tow. Murphy confesses that he made the mistake of telling her that Lou Cody was there with the journal. Yep. And Miss Kilbride declares that she has come to claim the gold on behalf of the California State Historical Society. And she's very, very emphatic in that pronouncement. I mean, it's just like she's planted her flag in the ground and, you know, I staked my claim.
Yeah.
I'm not sure that declaring something makes it so, though. I mean, Michael Scott walked out into the bullpen and declared, I declare bankruptcy, but it really didn't mean anything.
I thought that was the whole, I thought that was entirely how America operated. Stick a flag somewhere and it's yours. Isn't that how it works? Manifest destiny?
Sure, why not?
My God, that's how.
Yeah.
That's how you guys own the moon, well, right?
Yeah. Well, you know, it still happens. It's called, government goes in, they take your property and they say, it's for the public interest and here's a pittance for it.
Yeah.
But, yeah, still happens. Well, a few moments later, Felix Murrieta arrives driving his ubiquitous. Wow.
This is funny.
Forget
Keep going.
It. Driving the red LTD. Hey, my tongue got from my eye. I think I couldn't see what I was saying.
We'll record that and put it on a loop. Just.
Well, yeah, fine. Be that way.
You know what? I heard about the word ubiquitous once and suddenly it was everywhere. Sorry. So sorry.
You need to apologize for that joke.
I'm so sorry. On behalf of Steel Watching, I apologize for the worst pun.
No, that still goes to Abbott and Costello.
Yeah, that's true.
But this is close. Anyway, so he's got a horse trailer attached to the LTD.
Yeah.
And he's wearing glasses, which Steel seems to think indicates that maybe the colored contact Laura found is his.
Yeah.
But again, there's nothing to suggest that the contact that they found is corrective and that having lost it, the killer would have to resort to wearing glasses. So his logic is a little bit fuzzy.
Well,
there.
Not necessarily, because if they lost the contact and they're the killer, they might be just trying to hide the fact that they have one colored, like two different colored eyes.
Right. But his presumption is that his presumption seems to be that it's corrective.
Okay.
Well, because of the reference earlier to it being a prescription.
True.
But yeah, you're right. You're right.
I wonder if in the 80s you could only get colored contacts through a prescription. Maybe it wasn't available to just buy.
Mm. I suppose that's possible.
Yeah. I mean, I don't know, but.
Anyway, after Felix arrives, he and Miss Kilbride get into a minor disagreement about her driving and the ownership of the gold. Felix employs what Steele generously labels interesting logic in claiming that since his ancestor, his great grandfather stole the gold, it is somehow morally his.
Yeah.
I would call that interesting logic. Felix says that while his family was the finest banditos, or were the finest banditos north of Guadalajara, now they are reduced to hustling used LTDs. But with the gold, his family could regain a piece of its noble past. They might even get into Datsuns and Toyotas. It's like, seriously?
Do they even sell Datsuns anymore? Those can't be around.
Yes and no. Interesting you asked that question. Datsun was the American brand name for Nissan.
Oh.
And after many years of selling in the U.S. under the name Datsun, they adopted the actual name of the company that was making the cars everywhere else and changed it to Nissan.
Huh.
Yeah, same company.
Interesting. Same cars. Okay, cool. The things you learn, the more you know.
Yes. So anyway, Kitty Dobbs shows up. She's also wearing glasses. She gets out of the car, walks up to Felix, and snidely tells him, "You almost lost me at the fork, but I just followed the smell of the mules." At least I thought it was the mules. Yeah. Oh. Oof. None of these people are likable.
No.
This is not the first episode we've had like this, but none of these people are likable at all.
I think the only one that mildly becomes likable is Dobbs at the end. DeVore/Dobbs. He.
Yeah.
Yeah. The rest of them are not worth.
Even he. Yeah, but I mean, he's kind of sleazy and dishonest, so he's the worst of a bad lot.
Yeah,
let's say.
He's
the best of a bad lot. So after Katie Dobbs has shown up and had her little snide comments, Chance McCormick arrives by helicopter. He strides up to the group, and we see that he is also wearing glasses, and Laura realizes that identifying the murderer by identifying the owner of the colored contact lens, yeah, not going to work.
Well, I mean, this is one of those things where, what did she expect? It's bright sun in the desert. Mm-hmm. They're going to have sunglasses on. I mean, be rather, like, okay, they don't, but it's not that unheard of to wear sunglasses when you're out in the hot sun.
But when you're a detective, you don't think about these things.
Yeah, maybe not. And also, they're probably not going to wear them at night unless they're, what's his face? Who wears his sunglasses at night? Yeah. Oh, shoot. The name's escaping me.
90s, 80s?
Yeah. 90s, 80s starts reference? With a C. I wear my...
Corey Hart.
I mean, it was a Corey. It was a he wears his sunglasses at night, but everyone else will probably take them off.
Anyway, as McCormick arrives, he is also unfriendly in his greeting to the assembled group. He says, competition, I love it. Being the first one to the gold wouldn't be half as much fun if I didn't know there was a string of losers trailing behind. Yeah, like I said, none of these people.
No.
Miss Kilbride turns to Remington, and she basically throws him under the bus by first reminding everybody that no one will be able to find the gold without the journal. And that Steele's got it.
And he'd rather die than give it up, which Steele disagrees with. Yeah.
Nicely put, but inaccurate. Yeah, obviously he's not that dedicated to his job.
No.
And during all this, Murphy's been noticeably absent.
Yeah.
And Laura has also unnoticeably slipped away from the group, and they suddenly appear and seem to be in the midst of an argument. It seems that they've both fallen under the spell of gold fever.
Dun, dun, and dun. That they're
at each other's throats. Except that it's pretty obvious, even at this point, it's an act. Murphy is an overacting ham.
Yeah, he really is.
After Murphy storms out, put that in sarcasm quotes, even Steele comments that Murphy's, well, he's a bit wooden, but he played well enough for the provinces. Yeah. But I did have a question. Did Steele know it was an act beforehand, or was Murphy's acting really just so bad that he just simply picked up on it? Because after his comments, Laura tells Steele that she wants their suspects to think Murphy is against them so that they will confide in him when Steele and Laura go after the gold. That explanation really wouldn't be necessary if he already knew the plan, which suggests that Murphy's acting was so bad that Steele picked up on it during the performance and picked up on the plan during the performance. And if he did, why would they believe that nobody else would have picked up on it?
Well, and I think that also comes back to the whole Murphy turning that quickly seems unlikely.
Mm-hmm.
So if it doesn't work here, it doesn't really work later when it's supposedly real. Mm-hmm. But I can see that I definitely think he picked up on it because it was so over the top. That it just seemed, and he's seen Laura do this act before. I mean, they did it in the Hearts of Steel when she was pretending to be a angry, almost divorcee when she swung her purse at him and, you know, really sold it. So,
yeah. So, again, I mean, if Steele was able to pick up on it, I think everybody else there picked up on it as well. So, when Laura's telling Steele her plan, I think she realizes that Steele really only heard the part about where he and she go after the gold.
Yeah.
Because she warns him that they are only going after the gold in order to find the murderer. And he faces disinterest in the gold, saying, of course, the gold is secondary, tertiary,
really an afterthought.
So,
for God's sake, Laura, get a handkerchief, Chief.
You're drooling. It's interesting, though, that it almost seems to me that Laura had gotten into the role of her argument with Murphy enough that she actually seems to have some residual anger.
She does. Which comes out
as part of her disgust towards Steele. She makes that comment, get a handkerchief, you're starting to drool. She must have really gotten into it.
Yeah, it's not just that. When he walks over to her and goes to grab her, she pulls back and almost snarls at him. And then he says it's a okay performance. He's a bit wooden or whatever. But she's still, like, breathing heavily. And you can see, like, I think she was kind of... She got into the role, which is funny because normally she's so bad at undercover.
Yeah.
But yeah, yeah. She
got so into it that she kind of got herself lost into it.
Yeah.
At this point. Yeah. So we have another time jump. A lot of time jumps in this one.
Yeah.
The next day, the group is preparing to head out in search of the gold. But there's been a bit of sabotage going on by various members of the group in an effort, presumably, to get an upper hand. Thiel has sabotaged McCormick's helicopter by removing the injectors, which he admits to Laura by pulling them out of his pocket, wrapped in a red bandana, and shows to her. And that red bandana comes in later.
Yep.
And in turn, someone has sabotaged Steele's jeep. Felix Marietta, the only one who actually seems to have shown up prepared for the trip into the mountains.
Right?
By having brought suitable transportation. Yeah. He offers Steele, Laura, and Miss Kilbride the use of some of his mules for $500 a piece.
$500.
Was it a piece or was it for all three? That was a question I was going to ask.
I don't know.
It wasn't real clear.
No. But either way,
that's the economy model.
An insane amount of money for some mules.
Yeah. Hey, when you've got the only thing in town, you can charge that's what you true. Want, I guess.
Supply and demand.
So during this, there is, of course, the sound of the unseen Emmett DeVore laughing, at which Steele stands up and announces, "Captain, we're leaving.
We're going this way." Which, again, is kind of funny because if he is the murderer, why invite him to follow you?
Well, they make a reference to that a little bit later that, you know, as long as they're all together, they know where everybody's at.
That's true.
So there's no surprises. But he's not really with them because we don't see him in the group. But we do see the troop riding mules through the desert with Laura leading the way and DeVore undoubtedly trailing behind them out of sight. After traveling all day, they make camp. As they're sitting around having their dinner, Steele is reading from the journal.
Yeah.
Redneck and Two Eyes are again mentioned, but a new character is introduced, Blackie.
Yeah.
Apparently, Blackie was a friend of Dobbs, who was with him on the final trip to bring out the gold. But Redneck and Two Eyes were closing in. Dobbs took the task of leading them away from the camp while Blackie hid the gold in an old Indian burial ground.
It's always a burial ground.
Of course. If it wasn't, it wouldn't be a Western movie.
Yeah, or a horror movie, right? Like Pet Sematary. It's always
called a graveyard.
Burial ground, graveyard, same thing, right?
Yeah, but one's Old West, one is horror movie.
Fair.
Anyway, as Steele's talking, Laura seems to spot something. I don't know what it is she sees. But she sees something, and she tells Steele that she needs him to create a diversion. So next we see Kitty Dobbs, who's apparently set up away from the main camp.
Yeah.
And she has a veritable drugstore of cosmetic supplies laid out beside her as she does her nails.
Not to mention her headphones are on. She's singing to herself.
Yeah. Yeah. She's definitely not an outdoor girl.
No.
Steele stealthily comes up to her, and in his typically transparent faux sincerity, he tells her that ever since that first day in his office, he's been tormented with visions of them together. Yeah. After which he takes her off into the direction from whence he came. And as they're leaving, for him to occupy her time, Laura sneaks into the camp area and steals Kitty's bag.
Yeah.
I guess she needed some makeup for herself. She left it. But Steele has Kitty alone, and he continues his faux seduction, telling her, "From the moment I looked into your Eskimo green eyes, Eskimo brown eyes,
your one green eye, the one brown eye,
light bulb goes off, and Steele realizes that the colored contact was Kitty's. Kitty pulls away from Steele, pulls a knife from somewhere.
Yeah.
I don't know where, but it just magically appears.
Best not to ask.
And what?
It's probably like hidden somewhere we don't want to know about. That's all.
What was that from?
There's an episode. That scene is in Doctor Who. There's Jack is totally naked.
We've talked about this before. Yeah, we talked about this before. Anyway, won't go there. Steele takes a knife from her and remarks that the journal spoke of somebody with one green eye and one brown eye. And Kitty admits that she's not Arnold Dobbs' daughter. She's Dan Curtin's daughter, and that she's there to get revenge on whoever killed her father. But she says she didn't kill Lou Cody, and says when she was in the saloon, the time she dropped her contact, all she found was a pool of blood. Their conversation is interrupted by the sound of Miss Kilbride yelling. Felix Murrieta is struggling with her to take the journal, and Steele jumps in to stop Murrieta, thus beginning what Laura afterwards calls an epic battle.
This is a good fight.
Yeah, it must be a good fight because they destroyed the entire camp, chased away the pack mules, and lost all the supplies. Epic.
Yeah, but it's fun to watch. Like, Steele falling, Murphy picking him up, throwing him back in there, and just like rolling over the fire, rolling the other way over the, like, it's good. It's very, very well choreographed. It's very comical. It's exciting, and it, you know, it effectively damages everything in the camp. So
yeah. It reminds me of the cartoons where some character is trying to sleep and there's a fly bothering him, and he's bound and determined to get that fly and winds up completely, totally destroying his house in the process of just trying to get this fly, but he gets the fly.
I mean, that's how I behave when a fly is in my apartment. I will kill it.
You're not getting your deposit back.
No.
Anyway, after the battle, Steele wonders out loud what might have set Felix off. Sylvia Kilbride says she was reading aloud from Mr. Dobbs's journal, where he was reminiscing in the most torrid terms about his Mexican lady friend, his Sierra Tesora. Mm. And when Señor Murrieta heard that, he went quite bananas, she says in her very proper tone of voice.
Yeah.
Well, Steele's concerned about security of the journal. Laura tells him not to worry. It's in the last place anyone would suspect, on Miss Kilbride's gentle person. To which this gentle person warms that she'll blast the first bugger who tries to get his thieving hands on it.
To which Laura's like, her too?
Yeah. Well, next morning, Steele and Laura awaken to find out that they've been deserted.
Yep.
Everyone and everything is gone. And as they're looking around in stunned disbelief, they hear a raspy coughing sound and the weak voice calling to them for help. They follow the sound in their stocking feet.
Yeah. Yeah.
I mean, it's obviously uncomfortable. You can see, especially Laura, how she's walking very gingerly. Why didn't they slip on their boots? They're sitting right there.
Right. Or at least some sort of, I don't know if you could bring slippers with you, but like something. Because you would think if the desert does get quite cold, their feet would be cold.
Mm-hmm. And the sand gets very hot and the rocks in it get very hot. And there's sharp rocks, sharp things in the sand. Yeah, I mean, you had your boots right there. Just slip them on. Yeah. You didn't have to take the time to put your socks on. I mean, you're just going somewhere for a few minutes, right? Anyway, they find Murphy partially stripped and staked to the ground, Old West style.
Poor guy.
So obviously, somebody didn't buy the act.
No.
We jump forward a bit. We see Steele, Laura, and Murphy, who is trailing behind, wandering through the desert on foot. And this is where Steele comments that obviously they didn't buy Murphy's performance. Murphy collapses and begins the drama queen act. Okay.
Yeah.
Let's just call it what it is. He begins doing a drama queen thing, crying for water. And Laura tells him, well, we all need water.
Yeah.
And frankly, I'm not sure Laura really believes that Murphy's as bad off as he's acting.
No.
I think she's realizing he's acting a bit like a drama queen.
And I would buy this a little bit more if it was heat exhaustion or like he had been, right? But they're all out there. So theoretically, if it was heat exhaustion, they'd all be suffering from it to some extent. And and they seem fairly okay. You know, they're tired and they want water, obviously, but they're not flipping their lid, you know, or acting like.
Yeah.
Yeah, they're being.
And we don't see any evidence that it's been days.
No.
And that they've been without water for a couple of days.
Yeah, this is like
first
thing
like
in the morning.
It's
been a few hours. Yeah. Like, chill out.
Okay, now granted, in the desert, it doesn't take very long to get very hot.
True.
And so a couple of hours can be very hot, but it would take longer than that to get to the point where you are just so dehydrated, you're just crying and begging
Murphy,
for water.
Yeah, Murphy, yeah. This is And then not him. He's just after the gold. Okay.
You know, and he just, he says Steele doesn't care anything about anything. He doesn't need the water. Steele suggests to Murphy that the pressure's too much for him, and Murphy accuses Steele and Laura of wanting to leave him behind and keep the gold for himself. And then he begins hollering nonsense.
Yeah.
Starts trying to do jumping jacks, starts shadowboxing, starts gyrating, and then, of course, in the process, loses his balance and falls down the hill.
Yeah, and I just, this is one of those secondhand embarrassment moments, because I'm watching him and I'm just like, dude, what are you doing? You're embarrassing yourself. This is a hard turn. 1 minute he's totally rational and only pretending, and then what, 12 hours later he's a raving nutcase? Why?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And see, this is kind of what I was meaning, this sort of thing, when I was saying that Murphy is not being well handled here in the script.
No, I agree.
That it's a bit out of character for him.
Yeah. This is the, if they had gradually built up to it, I could have bought it a little bit more if they had, but the only evidence we see is that one other moment that you pointed out earlier, and that's it. There's,
And like I said, if we had seen evidence that this had been going on for days, that they had been out there, they had been traveling after having been abandoned, and it had been days, that could make a little more sense. But just, okay, we went to bed last night, we woke up, oh, it's 10 o'clock in the morning, I think I'm going to go nuts. No.
Oh, look, it's 10 o'clock. Time for me to lose my mind.
Yes.
Yeah.
Well, down at the bottom of the hill, Steele and Laura follow Murphy down. Yeah. He's down at the bottom of the hill. He seems to have calmed down.
Yeah.
And as he pulls up and lifts himself off the ground, he sees Miss Kilbride and Emmett DeVore surrealistically sitting under her parasol, relaxing and drinking champagne. And for some reason, I don't know why, this brings to mind Natalie Wood in The Great Race.
Yeah.
I don't know why.
Yeah.
Something about it. The parasol. I don't know.
It's just so bizarre, almost. It's... Yeah.
Yes. Yeah, it's almost like we're supposed to, at least for the first second or so, believe that Murphy's hallucinating and seeing.
Yeah, I thought mirage.
Because, you know, this is the kind of thing that they would do in a movie.
Yeah, but it's because they seem perfectly comfortable. Yeah. And again, they don't seem like the sun has negatively affected them. They're sitting there having some champagne and they're drinking, you know, which alcohol dehydrates you. So if you're that badly off for water, you're probably not going to be drinking wine or champagne or anything alcoholic. They seem perfectly comfortable.
Well, unless that's all you've got.
True.
But
yeah.
So Murphy finally collapses and whispers the word rosebud. I mean, champagne. So then we see DeVore and Kilbride making excuses when Steele confronts them. And essentially he's accusing them of being in league with the others, and DeVore makes his excuse that, well, no, we're not in league with them. We just simply went ahead to scout the lay of the land.
Sure.
We're going to be your pathfinder, so to speak.
Sure. Yeah.
But Murphy blows that by saying, I found the journal in his pack on his mule.
Yeah.
And then, of course, Miss Kilbride tries to sell the story, claiming that, well, when Captain DeVore came to me in the middle of the night and asked for the journal, he assured me that Mr. Steele simply wanted the two of us to be a step ahead of the others. Mm-hmm. In the middle of the night, he comes to you and says, Steele told him that?
Yeah.
First of all, in the middle of the night, that doesn't make sense. No. And then why wouldn't Steele have just come to her and said it? I mean, no, she's lying.
Oh, yeah.
She knew it wasn't true. She made a deal with DeVore. And now she's trying to throw him under the bus. Everybody's trying to throw everybody else under the bus.
This is Survivor, and they booted him off the island, you know? I will admit, I've never seen Survivor. I have no idea how it works. I imagine it's someone either. Like this. So.
But we know the phrase. Yeah, we know the phrase.
You're off the island.
So Murphy, again, goes off. He was just calm a few minutes ago, but now he goes off the deep end again, accusing DeVore of having found the gold, but lying about it.
And then saying that they want to bury him out here like a dog.
Yes.
Get the autopsy reports, Murphy. And that, what?
Yeah. And again, I have to wonder if this was a reference by Michael Gleason to Reed's dissatisfaction about the menial role that
I kind of wondered that too, because, maybe they knew already, probably they knew already that he wasn't coming back. So maybe it was kind of a sly kind of wink to Murphy's role thus far.
But yeah, he's gone off the deep end. As you said, he accuses them of wanting to bury him there like a dog and says he sees through their little scheme. He's wise to them. He's going to find the gold. And then he takes off running. And of course, Lawrence Steele reluctantly pursues. And as he's running, he slips, he falls, and finds himself face to face with a dried up skull.
Yep.
He also finds he's lying on top of a satchel. He slowly picks it up, opens it, and finds a stash of doubloons. And he excitedly dumps them out, shouting, it's mine, it's mine, it's mine. I hate
when people do this on TV, where they just dump money out everywhere. And I'm just like, dude, what are you doing? You're going to have to pick that up, okay? If each one of those doubloons is worth $1,000, don't be dumping it all over the place. What is wrong with you?
Yeah.
And then he says, where's the rest? Like, that's not enough for you?
There's got to be more.
It's probably like 10 grand.
It's a trick. It's a dirty, rotten, filthy trick.
I would take it.
Yeah. And then Laura slaps some sense into Murphy. Yeah. And one of the things that's fallen out of the satchel with the coins, because this is why he had to dump them out. Something had to fall out of there along with the coins. It's a scrap of paper.
Yeah.
Steele picks it up and he reads it. It's the last will and testament of somebody. The beneficiary is Arnold Dobbs, and they're understandably confused.
Yeah.
Laura ponders why Arnold Dobbs would have left all his worldly possessions to himself, but then she realized it wasn't Dobbs's will, it was Emmett DeBoer's. And Steele looks at the skeleton nearby and asks the logical question, well, if that's Emmett DeBoer, then who?
Who's the other guy?
And we have a hard cut where Laura, Steele, and Murphy are walking back, and she yells, Dobbs!
Yep.
So she's figured it out, but Kitty, Felix, and McCormick are confused.
Yeah.
When Laura demands an explanation, Dobbs recounts that he and DeVore, a.k.a. Blackie, who had been referenced in the journal, had been out in the desert. They'd been there for days. Their provisions were dwindling. The sun was driving them mad, he said. So they did the plan that they had previously discussed. Blackie would stash the doubloons in the burial ground, and he, Dobbs, would take off, leading Dan Curtin and Lou Cody, redneck as they used to call him, because he always wore a red bandana around his neck. He would lead them on a merry goose chase. And then after he'd escaped, he just simply kept the name Emmett DeBoer, knowing that Curtin and Cody would never stop looking for Dobbs.
His Irish accent also disappears here.
Mm-hmm.
Another one that just drops the accent once he's found out.
Yeah. DeBoer, he says, was a son of the sod. I, on the other hand, was born in Hackensack. So, yeah.
And
he drops the accent.
The actor who plays DeVore / Dobbs, and I can't remember his name. I've seen him a bunch of places. He's one of those, hey, that it's that guy sort of character actors. Uh-huh. And he's...
I've seen him before, yeah.
He's awesome. I just love him. As we've said, none of the characters are terribly likable, but his character is at least somewhat believable.
Tolerable?
Yeah. Yeah.
So he says that when Dan Curtin was killed at the party, his last words were not 80 loons, but A.D. doubloons, referencing the fact that he was surprised to see that Dobbs was alive, A.D. being Arnold his Dobbs, initials.
Yeah.
So Kitty concludes that Dobbs must have killed her father. So she rushes to attack Dobbs, but Murphy grabs her and tries to reason with her. I put that in sarcasm. Yeah. Don't kill him until we find out where the gold is.
He's so cartoonish.
Yes. Yeah. Very over the top. Felix suddenly has a realization. This is Arnold Dobbs. Then he wrote the journal. So then he asks, well, why did you write Sierra Tesora? And Dobbs says, well, that was a nickname for a friend of mine. Mm-hmm. We know what that is. I knew a long time ago, and it means mountain treasure. My mother's gringo mother used to call her that. Where were you in 52? Sonoma. Hey, caramba, I was born in Sonoma 52.
Poppy?
Son, Poppy. family reunions. Oh, they're so wonderful. Kitty bemoans the fact that some kids have all the luck. Miss Kilbride is confused as to who everyone is.
Just like the audience.
Tries to explain it.
At this point, the audience is like, okay, no, we need this pointed out here because we are so confused.
Yes, we need a scorecard. And of course, this is where Miss Kilbride says, well, thank heaven you are who you say you are, Mr. Steele.
Yeah.
And Steele gets kind of a I'm not going to say anything look on his face. And Steele comments that while the sight of a long-lost son rushing to his father's bosom might reduce him to strong emotion, it doesn't bring them any closer to finding his killer.
Yeah.
And Murphy says, not to mention the gold.
I roll my eyes every time he speaks at this point. I'm just like, okay, we get it. You know?
I had a question at this point. Steele had said, you know, while the sight of long-lost son rushing to his father's bosom might reduce him to strong emotion at some other time, is Steele considering himself and his lack of clear parentage in this comment? I mean, is that kind of what he's alluding to?
I wondered that too, but the answer to that would basically
if you put it in your notes, it doesn't count.
The answer, it's in my notes. I think the answer to that would depend on whether the writers knew where they were going with him. Because if they didn't at that point have the intention in mind that he doesn't know his parentage, he's not sure of his name, any of that stuff, then yes, this is a early clue. But if that came later, then this is a one-off line that's just a kind of funny statement, I think. So I think it really depends.
Funny coincidence.
Okay. We can take it to mean that's what it is, given what we know later on, given the canon of the show and the direction of it, but whether it was intentional?
Right.
Question mark.
Well, I was thinking of it in terms of the canon of the show that we know.
I would say for sure in terms of the canon of the show, it's one of those things where he would say as a joke, half the time whenever he speaks truth, it's sort of a one-off, or it's, unless he's talking to a character that's not Laura, it's kind of brushed off, right? So it definitely makes sense character-wise that he would make a kind of statement like this in a way that sounds like it's not truthful.
Tell the truth and make it sound like a lie so nobody believes it.
Yeah, pretty much. Yeah.
So anyway, as Steele is talking, he pulls out a red bandana, the one we saw earlier, and he wipes his brow with it, which makes sense. A wide brim hat is to keep the sun off your face, but doesn't actually keep you from sweating. It actually causes you to sweat more on the top of your head because it holds the heat in and prevents the air circulation from allowing the sweat to naturally evaporate. Yep. So it makes sense. But Laura's attention is captured by the bandana, and Dobbs says, wait, that's Lou Cody's bandana. And when Laura asks Steele where he got it, he says, well, he found it in McCormick's helicopter when he wrapped the injectors in it, when he was stealing them from off the helicopter. And McCormick realizes that the jig is up.
Yep.
He pulls a gun on the group. He admits to killing Cody and Dan Curtin because he wanted the gold, and said he was going broke with those, as he puts it, Fakakta computers. And do you know how much those Italians charge for their lousy satellite? I looked that word up.
It's Yiddish, isn't it?
And I found two definitions. One from the Jewish English lexicon says it means lousy, messed up, ridiculous. The Urban Dictionary references that it's Yiddish slang that means something else.
A sweary word or a vulgar word?
Oh, yes.
Okay.
Yes. That begins with the same letter.
Okay, gotcha.
Yes, but this is a family-friendly podcast, so we don't say things like
that.
We
just talk about murder. So it's fine.
Really. I mean, family-friendly.
Totally wholesome.
Family-friendly murders. That's what we do here. Yes. So McCormick announces that he's taking the mules, the water, the journal, and the satchel. Dobbs tosses down the canteen. Laura tosses down the journal, and Murphy, without thinking, tosses down the satchel. And as McCormick squats down to pick up the items, he tells him, it'll be a long time before anybody finds you up here. By then, you'll just be a bunch of bleached bones. And then as he's leaving, Laura leans over and grabs Murphy and tells him, he's got the gold. And again, Nutso Murphy comes to life and starts running at McCormick.
What is wrong with her? The man has a gun and she's basically pointed Murphy at him. What?
Yeah.
She's like, he's got the gold. Go get him. Go get him, boy. Go on. Like, he's Rover at this point. And she's just like, set him up. McCormick could turn and shoot him in the face. Yeah. Like, this is the dumbest idea ever.
Yeah. Well, I think Steele recognizes that because at the same time Murphy takes off, or just a fraction of a second later, Steele also takes off. And of course, they come at him, at McCormick from different directions. So he's back and forth. Which one do I shoot first?
Yeah.
Eeny, meeny, miny, mo. So he doesn't shoot anybody. And then a struggle ensues. The gun is knocked to the ground out of McCormick's hand. Steele grabs McCormick. Murphy grabs the satchel. Kitty runs over and grabs the gun, shouting, "You murderer!" Laura runs over and grabs Kitty. And then Murphy drops the satchel and runs over and grabs Dobbs, yelling, "Enough of this stupid detective business. Where's the gold? So,
yeah.
So, yeah, it's just a real, everybody's grabbing everybody else. Dobbs tells Murphy that if his calculations are right, the Indian burial ground is right over that rise. And he points to a rise off to the side. Murphy takes off running up the hill with the entire cast of characters running behind him. Murphy reaches the top first, and he's standing there motionless, hands shielding his eyes as the rest of the troop reaches the crest. And we don't see yet what he's looking at, but we see him as he's looking, and he says, "They built a shopping center over my gold.
They paved paradise, put up a parking lot."
Okay, Joni.
Sorry.
Okay, all you young people, Joni Mitchell, go look it up. Everyone's stunned in silence. Murphy begins to laugh, a sort of maniacal laugh, and Steele joins in with an ironic laugh. And Steele looks at Laura with some concern, and then we freeze. So, it's like I said at the beginning, it's a better episode than I was originally giving it credit for, but it's still not a great episode.
I think it falls apart in the third act.
Very confusing. You need a scorecard.
Yeah. It's a good setup.
And with everybody being everybody else and.
Yeah. By the end, you're like, who's it just gets who very now? Confusing. That's his son and that's kid.
Who's on first? What's on second? I don't know. Who's on third?
He's our shortstop. Yeah, exactly. That's pretty much what it is.
Okay, young people, Abbott and Costello, who's on first? Go look it up.
We're going to have to put a list of references at the bottom of the show notes. Like, okay, here's what a tape cassette is. No, I'm kidding.
So anyway, any additional comments about the episode? We've already kind of mentioned that it's very confusing.
Yeah.
Has its issues.
I think, like I said before, it's a good setup. It falls apart in the third act a little bit. It relies on us buying into Murphy's mania, which doesn't really fit. Mm-hmm. But there are some other moments in it that are genuinely pretty funny. So, the setup at the beginning with the clown and the bunny and the Sherlock and like all of that stuff is good. It's all good.
And the running gag about calling Murphy a clown, that's a good
it's
one.
I would say it's decent. It's certainly not terrible. I wouldn't skip over it, never watch it again sort of thing. But yeah, it has its issues. And again, I think it suffers from coming right after Vintage Steel.
But it's definitely better than Steel Among the Living.
Yeah. Yeah.
So
for sure.
Anyway, if that's it.
I think it is.
We'll mention we have a website, www.steelwatching.com. And there you can find show notes and Amazon links to the movies that were referenced, 39 Steps, Metropolis, Treasure of the Sierra Madre. And you can find support options so that you can help fund the podcast's continued existence, as well as some other things social media-wise.
Yeah, we've got a Facebook page, Instagram, Twitter. We also have the Facebook group, Steel Watchers, which is just a bunch of super cool Remington Steel fans hanging out, talking about the show. So all of those places you can find information about the podcast. But if you join the Facebook group, you just get to hang out. Fun times.
Yes. So next, Sting of Steel. Which is...
Daniel.
Yeah, it's a good one.
Daniel.
And Mother. And
Abigail. Yeah. Whoever thought to include both of them in an episode, chef's kiss. Brilliant idea.
All right. Well, that's it for this one. And looking forward to the next one. And we will talk to you later. Bye-bye, everybody. Hey, everybody. Eric and Sarah here. Just a quick announcement to let you know that, yes, we do appreciate everyone who listens, participates, and supports the podcast in whatever way you do. But we wanted to give an extra thank you to those who are so graciously giving to be monthly financial supporters.
We are making live streams of our recording sessions available to anyone who is a monthly financial supporter. So not only can you watch us live as we record our podcast episodes, you will be getting access to the raw, behind-the-scenes, unedited version of episodes before they get officially released.
And Sarah, does that include our mistakes and screw-ups and our humiliating?
Yes, it does. Every single one of them.
Every single one of them, yes. So again, this is just an extra thank you to those who are going above and beyond. But whether you choose to become a monthly financial supporter or not, we still love you. We want to say we thank you for your support, your encouragement, and your feedback.
If you want to become a monthly financial supporter, please visit our website at www.steelwatching.com to sign up.